Hello, and welcome back to the AgTech So What podcast, brought to you by AgThentic. I'm your host, Sarah Nolette. This episode jumps back to our Regen Ag series, this time with a debate. The debate was held at a recent live AgTech meetup, where we asked our panelists whether Regen Ag is greenwashing or good business.
It is such a clever word, because what is the opposite of regen? I'm a degenerative farmer. I'm not regenerative. I'll turn around and say 200 years on the same patch of dirt. I irrigate, I use fert, I drive tractors, and I'm making money, and I think my landscape looks good.
I just don't think we need to get tied up in the term too much, okay? If we're doing something that is beneficial for the landscape, I think we can all agree on that more plants, more diverse, more cover ticks a lot of boxes.
Yep, there are two sides to this debate, and that was just a taste of what's to come. Let me properly introduce you to our panelists. You just heard a bit from Richard Leask. He's a wine grower in the McLaren Vale area of South Australia, a region famous for its Shiraz, and he believes that regen is worth investigating. Also on the pro-regen side of the debate is Toby Grogan. Toby works as a natural capital specialist for a company called Impact Ag. And on the regen ag skeptic side is Will Bignell. You heard him at the start there too. Will describes himself as a conventional farmer, but I'm not sure if that's an accurate description. In addition to running a mixed farming operation in Tasmania, he produces boutique vegetables and cheeses and owns a drone company. So let's hear from our very impressive panelists directly. Richard is the first of the three to take the stage.
I'm a wine grower from McLaren Vale in South Australia, and, 2019 Nuffield Scholar, where I spent 12 months of the year last year going around the world looking at what is regenerative agriculture and where does it sit in terms of the vineyard industry. So it's a massive subject to try and sum up in 5 minutes. In terms of our brand and our business, we're on the journey. We've implemented most of the practices on one of our farms, and we're using a number of them across a few others, as well as consultancy business that we do. So we're in the testing phase, I would call it. We're seeing some interesting results, but there's still a lot we don't understand about it, and there's still a lot we don't know, but we're working our way through that. So I just want to quickly make a few points, obviously 5 minutes just to sum it up. Really what we're talking about here is system change from what we've been doing traditionally. I'll have a very vineyard-centric take on this, but just supplement if you're in the farming industry, your business, and we're working with the same substrates. What is carbon and what does it do for us? We know it's great for soil structure. We know it's good for aeration, particularly good for increasing the available water in soil, but none of that happens without the biology in the soil. So all of this stuff has to work in harmony, and how do we do that? We need plenty of plant cover. We need plenty of diversity in the soil to do that. And we need to give that system a chance to do it regularly and without too much disturbance. We know that cycling carbon, carbon is a cycle. It's used. The microbes use it. The plants use it. We're not necessarily talking about sequestration here. I'm talking about how to maximise the system to improve our soil organic matter, our soil structure, to give our plants that we're growing in it resilience, given that the seasons we've got are becoming a bit more challenging. That's the real quick upshot of it. The main driver of that is obviously the plant life that we use on it. So if we use a vineyard system, for example, we've got a permanent planting there that we can utilise, but we've also got a considerable amount of land that perhaps we can use in a slightly different manner. And the more we have above the ground, the more we're going to have below the ground, and that's going to help drive the system. So it's a very simple concept in that respect, but complex in a lot of other ways. So we've gone from cultivation to 7 herbicide passes a year to control what little organic matter we've got in the middle of the row. So I don't think anyone can argue that that's a sustainable or even a regenerative path moving into the forward. So we've got to have a plan B, because this isn't something that's going to take us into farming in the future. I think that sort of sets the context for where I'm looking and where we're trying to get to in terms of the journey.
Toby is also on the regen ag journey, not as a farmer, but as someone who works with farmers and investors to improve the health of their land and raise their overall productivity.
So I'm from Impact Ag. We're an asset manager based in Armidale, New South Wales, and we've got farms in Queensland, New South Wales and Western Australia. And all of those are being managed regeneratively and are on a journey to transition to a better ecosystem. Some of those we've been managing for 10 plus years, and others that we've just purchased. So before I start to show you some of our results, I probably need to define regen ag, which is sometimes a dangerous thing to do. But we see it as a regenerative ag, any farming system which aims to actively and profitably improve the farm's natural capital, so soil, biodiversity and the water cycle. So any management activity or management decision that leads to an improved ecosystem broadly and an impact ag, we are a data-driven business. So all our decisions need to be based on factual evidence and data. So the first thing that we focus on when it comes to measuring is productivity and financial metrics. If it's not profitable, it's not going to be successful. This is a graph from the Wilmot Cattle Company in northern New South Wales. You'll see a blue dotted line, which is the trend rainfall going down. You'll see a green line, which is the soil organic carbon levels going up. So this is a business that primarily through grazing management was able to improve their soil health and productivity. And the measure here I've used is soil carbon. So they've gone on a regenerative journey from 2010 through to 2016. And then they've more recently had some very tough years. And I think regen ag, you know, when you're getting climate conditions that enable you to impact the landscape you're working on, you've got an opportunity to regenerate it. When you go through a couple of years like we've just had, and the rainfall shows it here, the focus needs to be on protecting that landscape. So, you know, when you're able, regenerate it, and when you need to, protect it. And as I said, data-driven business, and we've got a bit of a case study that the My Grazing guys did for us on this asset, Bart Davidson. And this was on a small case study of one paddock on this property that went from 60 hectares to 9 paddocks of 6.5 hectares. And over a 4-year period through My Grazing, we measured a doubling of grass yield or an increase in 220 kilos per hectare per 100 mil. So that to me sounds like good business.
Will, however, is not convinced that regen ag is good business. In fact, he's worried that producers could lose money and ultimately even their farms by following regen ag philosophies.
I'm a seventh generation farmer down in Tassie, basically been here since the original land grant. What that means is we have a lot of junk lying around. 7 generations of social history as well, so social capital as I term it, understanding our landscape. And our business has been incredibly diversified over those generations. We've gone from 100,000 acres, currently I'm farming about 4,000 acres or 1,700 odd hectares now, a mix of grazing, overhead irrigation with pivot irrigators, and running a mix of poppies, barley for sheep feed and dairy feed. That's my core business as such. But however, my father pioneered the deer industry in Australia. We've got one of the first 4 permits to farm deer. We farm deer killed on the farm. We milled flour. We've got Australia's oldest flour mill. We have grown all sorts of boutique vegetables. We started small-scale farmhouse cheese making, milking sheep and goats, selling direct to restaurants, growing 2 million strawberry runners a year, all that sort of stuff, alongside running, you know, still 10 to 15,000 sheep on our properties as family businesses. And it's 7 generations of succession, which is quite hard to manage, to put it mildly. So my background is this big farming business, but I'm also a pretty curious character. So I ended up going to uni, did a Bachelor of Ag Science, came back for a year, which was the 05, 06, 07 drought in Tassie. So we got hit really hard. Where we are is a very much a microclimate, and we get a bad hit. So it had the millennial drought of 2000, what was it, 05, 06, 07, 08, where we had cut off our water rights, which is like cutting off your head to our business. And we had all this other diversification and we worked very hard at what we were doing, but we'd come off this base of very standard conventional farming. I'm at the point where I came home in the drought, I looked for something else to do and I went and did a PhD in molecular genetics. I enhanced long-chain omega-3 in Australian lamb and got stuck into that space, which is somewhere I never thought I would go. So I have a very sustainable, what a word to use, ethos towards farming. I am very passionate about the next generation. I mean, we're one of the oldest farming businesses in Australia, we've been told. So we take care. We regenerate our land. It's what we do. If we didn't, we weren't regenerative farmers. But I use all the inputs you can imagine. And the reason I fear regen is, and I'm quite anti it, is it's the magic pudding. It's the gift that keeps on giving is what they're promising. I understand the concept of soil carbon. We've been drilling for 40 years. My organic carbon levels in all my soils work. I try and conserve ground cover, but I also recognise I extract a huge amount of resources from the landscape. And no matter how hard I try, biological activity is driven by 100 mil of rain, per 100 mil of rain is driven by it. and you just can't put it back in. That's my ethos. We had the capital stripped out of the business pretty aggressively into diversification, and I've been working for 3 years really hard to bring it back up. And it's almost uneconomical, because my father was a very skilled grazier, and you learn how to read grass and graze properly and keep ground cover, come in on three leaf, do your feed budgets, and all of a sudden you get these massive, massive gains. You grow the weeds you've got, you eat the weeds you've got, you change the weeds you've got in that way in your business. And I get really challenged by this idea, because regen really invigorates the end consumer. The buy-in is massive for it. It is such a clever word, because what is the opposite of regen? I'm a degenerative farmer. I'm not regenerative. And I'll turn around and say, I've got 200 years on the same patch of dirt. I irrigate, I use fert, I drive tractors, I import nutrients and I export heaps. And I'm making money, I'm happy, and I think my landscape looks good. So I get very torn by the whole concept. Ultimately, in agriculture, anyone who's smart and switched on, who's a good manager and a good business head on them, is going to succeed in ag regardless, especially if it's your own business. You've got that buy-in. And I put the fear of God in me that I'm watching people get really good at grazing, go and utilise a heap more feed, grow a heap more feed. They can up their stocking rate because they've just learned to graze. Then you turn around and say, no, you don't need to put on phosphate. Well, I can tell you now what happens after 15 years of drought and dry spells and diversification. You can't grow anything. So I'm here not as an antagonist, but yeah, to me, I just don't buy in. And I think that's the important thing. And the consumers are buying in left, right and centre, but you don't see farmers buying in. And to me, that raises alarm bells. When a brand is holding the system up and saying, this is it, and you're not getting farmers buy in, I just smell a rat.
I want to jump to Richard, actually, or back to Richard, to the points Will's making. Is that consistent with what you're seeing globally, that farmers aren't buying in, or maybe there's a difference in corporate farms versus family farms in terms of buy-in that you might have seen overseas?
Look, I think the regen thing's still gaining ground, to be honest, Sarah. I mean, all of the places I went to, I think most of them started as either organic or biodynamic. Certainly in our industry, biodynamic is quite strong. So I think they start there and then they transition. And I don't disagree at all with some of Will's points. And if anyone's interested, my report's out. And my addition to the principles that are well written about is that the nutrient balancing in landscape is important. And I don't think we should get hung up on whether that is a bit of well-timed synthetic or whether there's some organic or whether there's a bit of both. What I like about the potential of regen is that we take the best out of a lot of these systems, and it's about finding the bit that suits you. Now, these aren't off-the-shelf things. They're a set of guidelines that I think you can use that suit your business. So in that context, I think there's interest in it. I'm interested in it because I think there's huge upside in the piece of land that the wine industry's got that they currently use to drive tractors on, and really don't think about how they can be utilised for the ecosystem benefits for the vineyard as a whole. So that's a very narrow focus for us. And I understand that, and I really like some of the figures that Toby's put up, because that helps talk about some of the gains that perhaps as an industry we can make if we just increase some soil carbon by doing some of these things. And I think, back to Will's point, it's valid. We're exporting nutrient every time we take fruit off the property. I've seen some really good examples, but yet to be totally convinced in a high production horticultural setting that these systems will run and manage themselves without any inputs from us. So, it's a work in progress. It's not to say it can't be done, but at the moment, there's still a lot of stuff we don't know. So it's got grounding in the US for sure, but it's a very counterpoint to the current ag system. They're miles apart, and that's why it's got some voice. But whether it's across the mainstream, it's probably yet to be decided.
Toby, I know you're talking to investors in terms of what impact ag does. What's the investor conversation like, and how much of your thinking about regen ag is driven by that ability to attract capital or really tell that story to investors, or do they care about the data and that kind of evidence base as well?
They certainly care about the data component. And I think it's important that farming can get a lot of bad press around whether it's animal welfare or climate impact. So for us, it's a bit about neutralizing that as well and presenting agriculture in the best light. And, we are now at a position where we've been collecting this data and analyzing this data ourselves for 10 years. We're not a business that has appeared last week and decided we're regen and, you know, we're going to save the world. We're a business that is built on a decade of data that demonstrates that we can, with lower inputs, certainly not no inputs, but lower inputs, with management change, increase productivity, increase the returns. So those financial metrics are obviously integral to the financial or investor market. And it's about being able to present that data coherently and with enough history to, you know, reduce their view of risk in agriculture. The other thing I would say is, from an investor point of view, the climate change and being able to invest, whether it's a small family investor that we deal with or a large corporate, being able to invest their money into something that can demonstrate that it is a low impact or it is carbon positive investment is increasing exponentially. And as an industry, I think we are pretty well positioned to present ourselves as being a low carbon investment, and in the best case scenarios, a carbon positive investment.
I'm really curious to hear from all of you about this challenge of kind of principles-based versus evidence-based and the excitement around how Regen Ag sounds and some of those climate benefits with the on-the-ground challenge of, do I actually change what I'm doing and what level of evidence do I need before I'm actually going to risk the bottom line to get started with maybe what does lack evidence, but I might believe in. How do you think about that balance, Will?
I'm scared of it. Like in the position I was in, we were heavily destocked. Nutrients were gone, fences were gone, and it all takes capital. So to regenerate a landscape takes a heck of a lot of money. Phenomenal. Like I run my overdraft through the red line all the time, just trying to get that fence in to lock that north-facing slope off, to stop erosion, to get that bit under control. You know, it all takes money. And the worst thing about this system is it's a slow burner. It's a real burner on finance. And I'm part of the Holmes and Sackett benchmarking group, which is one of my, I love it. It lets me look at my business against everyone, what I'm doing. And they did a review against Regenerative Ag. And basically on a similar asset base to me over a 10-year period, I'm $1 million down. I'm $1 million behind on that system. So that's hard data that comes at me. There are aspects of the benchmarking that I shudder at and go, whoa. But yeah, the philosophical challenge for me, and then being an analytical scientist, like I live for data, like molecular genetics is this black box of data and associations and all sorts of give and take. And so the farming is exactly the same. Having a PhD and coming back to the farm, you know, a lot of people say, what a waste. And I'm like, nah, it's post-hole digger. That's what it stands for. But it's actually my skill set stretched to its limit, just thinking this huge complex system and analyzing it. And yeah, I love empirical data, but I also go on gut feeling a lot as well.
You just heard Will mention Holmes and Sackett, an Australian agricultural consultancy that provides, amongst other things, benchmarking services, analyzing how farm businesses compare with each other. Toby says he uses Holmes and Sackett and other data comparison tools to make sure their regen ag practices are, in fact, improving the profitability of their farms.
So benchmarking is a very important tool, and we've got to achieve similar results or better results than industry standard if we're going to claim that we are good regenerative farm managers and you can do it profitably. You know, I would say we've transitioned a number of properties from a conventional through to what we would call a regenerative system and done a lot of data, assessed a lot of data around the cost of that transition. And in many cases, we haven't found it to be an expensive process. The Wilmot Cattle Company and Meyer Grazing did a case study on that one paddock, splitting it up into nine, and they spent $125 on water and wire, a single hot wire and a trough system. Two-thirds of that cost was in the trough system to, over a 4 or 5 year period, double the productivity of that, the pasture production of that subdivision. So that's doubling the carrying capacity, $125 a hectare. If we were to go and buy the neighbour's paddock in that part of the world, it would cost us $8,000 a hectare. You know, the Holmes and Sackett response to the regen report I've read, but I think there's, in both instances, there's good key takeaways of both those reports. But I certainly wouldn't discredit the benchmarking data and the expertise that an organisation like that has.
There's been some back and forth on that, I think, catalysed by the Australian Farm Institute. But yeah, it kind of goes, I guess, to the some of the heart of the question around this evidence base and this definition. And there's questions around, well, is, you know, changing the stocking rate particularly regenerative, and some kind of ambiguity around, is this just a catch-all marketing term, or is this a actual set of things that, that has evidence behind it? Richard, how do you think about that? You mentioned principles. How do you think about that?
Look, I think it's both. I mean, I can give you some real-time cost on, you know, the system change for us, because like, again, I think there's huge upside for Vineyard, you know, and we're utilizing livestock in a couple of places that have taken out 2 to 3 tractor passes at the start of the season for us. Now that's just a real-time cost at $100 a hectare every time you get on a tractor to do something. That's money that's straight back into your bottom line. So that's an easy win. You know, some of that livestock's been leased, some of it's been grown out by us, so there's another income stream. For very little infrastructure other than a hot wire in a lot of places, but also like we'll, you know, some of it we've had to do some significant fencing, but it's a one-off cost. So there's certainly huge potential in it, but it depends a bit where you're at. Obviously, my goal to go around the world was to pick holes and pick out the good bits out of, you know, arable farming, cropping systems, grazing systems, anything that looked like that managed grass and plants, and utilize that into a vineyard setting. We know that we've got some challenges coming up around whether it be market around herbicide, or whether we've already got challenges around resistance to herbicide in vineyards. So that's not a feasible thing going forward. You know, if you don't have a plan B for that, you're going backwards. And we know that cultivation isn't the answer either, because it's costly. Every time you do it, it's costing you money. And if again, at $100 a hectare, you can't go from one herbicide or two herbicides a year to 3 cultivation passes, because it's costing you more money and it's doing more damage to your soil. So this is where the regen bit comes in for me. Now, I just don't think we need to get tied up in the term too much, okay? If we're doing something that is beneficial for the landscape, I think we can all agree on that more plants, more diverse, more cover ticks a lot of boxes, okay? That's better than less plants, cultivation, and bare ground. It's got no photosynthetic capacity at all. It does no one any good. So rather than get too worried about who's regen and what's not regen, let's focus on the things that we know work, and we can talk about the stuff that we don't know yet. That's coming. I'm a bit like Toby. I've read plenty of reports that suggest both sides of the argument. So that tells us that we're still working on these things, but it's a, you know, it's a three-dimensional system. You know, they're really hard to measure and triple replicate and do all those things. You come back to your own system and say, what's my key goal here? Now, for me, it was to improve my water holding capacity, or at least plant available water, and reduce my costs. And how do I do that? And I'll look at some of these processes and do it. You know, if we go to, again, another example is cover cropping. The growers that are going around putting in single species cover crops have been doing it for years. Yeah, that's doing some good, but then it takes 3 cultivation passes to set it up. There's 3 tractor passes. The arable guys have worked this out years ago, where they just direct drill it mostly. Yeah, they use a bit of herbicide to get it right, but that's a better system than what that's doing. So let's utilize some of that knowledge and transfer it across into our own systems.
Will, you were shaking your head and nodding. Are you going to jump in
there?
Yeah,
I think that's the danger in it, though. You're cherry-picking it. Like, what you're describing is the leading edge of conventional ag. Like, I run a UAV company, operate drones all over the world, and I see a lot of paddocks and a lot of data. And, like, you watch Cole the Corn Star or the Millennial Farmer on YouTube, I mean, they're huge conveyors of ag. And you watch what they're doing with a Yetta system and their press wheels and the fuel burn on the tractor. Like, that's just conventional farming. It's smart farming, using pressure and trash residues and mechanical techniques. Like, that's what I fear in it. It cherry picks it and people don't see the whole concept. And like we're looking at the bottom end of the bell curve in agriculture. So it's good management is what you guys are describing. And I mean, regen's just cell grazing rebranded, as far as I'm concerned. It's exactly the same. But the problem, the danger to me is that you're taking a beautiful concept of a conventional farmer. Like, I am super high tech with what I do. The amount of remote sensing I have going on and variable applications and whatever, I'm pushing it. But then regen, you're pushing a brand out that the default position is degenerative. So if I'm a really smart, switched on, cutting edge, UAV operating, variable rate irrigator guy doing his thing, I'm degenerative, default position. And that bugs me.
I want to jump into that tech point. There's a couple questions here around what kind of technologies, monitoring, et cetera, are you using in these farms, and especially when it comes to regen ag or just improving soil and land management?
So I run a 2,000 hectare Wi-Fi mesh, private Wi-Fi mesh, with something like 300 access points, everything from turning PowerPoints on and off to save energy, through to I have soil moisture probes in all my cropping paddocks. They measure down to 80 centimetres. I watch all my irrigation infiltration. I run variable rate irrigation on individual sprinklers. I have a kilometre long irrigator that does 200 degrees, pushes the boundaries of irrigation. A variable rate soil test every paddock, replace all my capital P. We've got five trial sites on our farm that are lifetime trial sites on tree recruitment to pasture species, deep core organic carbon levels of our soil, north-facing slope trials, like we do heaps of stuff. And I'm 80 k's away from the farm. I don't live on the farm as such, just the way succession panned out. And so I farm remotely from cameras. I'm not exceptional in what I do.
As the debate was heating up and we started digging into ag tech, it was clear that no one thinks that simply deploying tech on farm or collecting data is enough, at least not yet, to answer the question of whether regen ag is worthwhile. Will uses a lot of technology and remains completely unconvinced by the claims of regen ag. But Toby and Richard also use the latest tech to understand what they're seeing on farm, and for them, it does back up their regen claims. So what's going on here? Do we need more data, better tech? Are emotions getting in the way? Is perhaps a comfort with longstanding business models in agriculture influencing decision-making? I asked Will if we're simply using high input systems in some cases because that's what we've always done.
Yeah, it's very, you know, Holmes and Sackett call them parasites on your business, all these advisors and sales reps and stuff. It's so easy to get complacent. You know, you get the free Eskies, the hat, the Leatherman, the little mini bike for the kids. You know, they read you perfectly. And it's so easy to become complacent and the parasites feed on you, basically. But that comes back down to the individual, regardless of what colour hat you wear and what camp you sit in farming. If you let them run, they'll run with you and they'll clean you up. Their job is to make money off you. And a lot of people I've seen that fall into that trap do just solely rely on an agronomist or someone for their input. And, you know, Toby's business and stuff, you know, alternative views, the data they put out and analysing that yourself and centering yourself around what you want to do. That's the critical thing. A good manager is going to win regardless of what hat they wear because they're managing their business.
Richard, thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll play devil's advocate for Will. You know, I can find the vests and the chemical company hats and bits and pieces as well. We can get on the treadmill of continuous pest and disease control and herbicide control and that whole thing. You know, so where do we get off? You know, I keep looking at what I'm doing and saying, well, what am I in this for perpetuity? Do I have to continue to do this to my plants to keep them alive? Is there a better way? You know, I'm viewing the lens and saying, well, how do I change this paradigm? Can I do it through soil biology and soil health to a degree? Can I do it with other ecosystem services by companion plantings and bits and pieces and other things? I don't say I'm going to go cold turkey, but can I get off some of this stuff? It's a drip feed. So, you know, it works both ways. And it's just about asking those questions. You know, I just think, you know, Will's point is valid. The good managers will always analyze their business. So for us, it's about, you know, what we're looking at in terms of system change is saying, before I go out and do what I've always done, is there a better way? And if you don't ask that question, then you're never going to know whether there's another answer to it. You know, I think the next big phase in ag tech will be biology and understanding how we utilize that and use it to our advantage and farm it. Some of that will be stuff that we can do on the land. Some of it will be inputs. But we understand the chemistry bit. We know how that works. We've been doing it in the Green Revolution for the last 50 years. The next big set will be how do we make the biology do some of this stuff for us? It may well be in transition with inputs, but if we don't give it a go, then we're not going to know. And that's where my mindset sits. I just think there's an opportunity to have a crack at some stuff. You know, don't do 4,000 acres off the top of your bat. But have a little bit in the corner where you're prepared to make a loss or, you know, have a failure on that isn't going to break you, but you might actually learn something. Because if we don't try something new, we're just going to be on the mouse wheel for however long we're on it until it falls off the hinges.
The danger of doing that, though, just little gains again and again and again, you don't go anywhere. You just make life bloody complex. I've seen it. That's what I lived through, was little experiments, little gains. Sometimes just going, I've got to get off this, got to restructure it. It's the best solution. Like to make money, you've got to be in it to capitalise in the long game in ag. There's no short game in it. It's a five-year system, I reckon. 3 years to change something, particularly in livestock, but 5 years to feel a system. If you're just experimenting every year, you're just experimenting. It's just a distraction. Focus on the core business. Manage it. Like, yeah, you've got to get off the treadmill. We're looking at your business. You know, that ethos, encouraging that. And I think the best way to do it's beer. Have a beer with your mates. You know, and the more you get, like, it's a Tasmanian thing here. We are very connected as young farmers, thanks to poppies. Huge money, and it brought a whole heap of us back. Like, brought me back from a PhD and postdoc, mates who are solicitors, lawyers, guys, some high flyers that have come back to farming. And I think the beer economy is a big part of it because we all chat. Like, we've got a farmers group. They met last Friday. A lot of this change comes through the beer economy as far as, you know, passing a beer goes, and off you go, and rethinking what you're doing and asking questions. And it comes back to the crux of that management. I'm just conscious of doing little experiments continually.
Toby has a slightly different view.
I think to get over those little experiments, every farmer wants to do little experiments. It's inherent in their management of their landscape. But if you're going to go and have a crack at something on a larger scale, that's where you need your trusted advisor. And, you know, one of Regen Ag's criticisms has been the lack of data and science behind it. I think that's changing and will change rapidly going forward because there's so much of a focus on it. You know, whether it's academic, whether it's technology, no single farmer is going to be able to get across that. You need to arm yourself, and that's what we do in our business, with those trusted advisors that will help you get that biodiversity offset, or will help you, you know, generate a carbon credit or implement a new practice.
And that's it for now on Regen Ag and this debate brought to you by AgThentic, SproutX, and Platform. But before you go, I'd love to know whether it has changed your view or solidified your view, or if you have any other feedback or thoughts on Regen Ag. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and at our website, agtechsowhat.com. Our next episode will be a wrap-up of the Regen Ag series. We've canvassed a lot of different opinions, from farmers to multinational food corporations. So listen back to our previous episodes if you've missed any. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell all your friends. I'm Sarah Nolette. Catch you next time on AgTech So What.